Welcome to Community Conversations, a monthly program on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson, and this evening we're talking about the Women's Economic Security Act. Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton signed the act into law on Mother's Day, and the Duluth City Council passed a resolution in support of it at their meeting the next day. In the next half hour, we'll take a look at the bill in more detail. We'll talk about what it does and doesn't do, and also talk about the role of men and fathers in today's Minnesota families. Plus, we'll look at some other concerns the bill hopes to address, the needs of victims of domestic and sexual assault, and elderly women in the state who are twice as likely as men to live in poverty. Now, let's meet our guests.
I'm Emily Larson, and I'm a Duluth City Councilor.
I'm J.P. Rehnquist. I'm a longtime activist and community organizer around issues of fathers and families. Most recently, I just finished up working on a project working with mothers and fathers with Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa.
And I'm Beth Bartlett, and I'm a professor of women, gender, and sexuality studies here at UMD.
Emily, let's start by talking about the ways the Economic Security Act benefits women. There are a number of different segments of the legislation, and let's talk about how they work and why they're important.
So WESA is the Women's Economic Security Act. It was, as you say, signed into law by Governor Dayton on Mother's Day. And it's actually a package of several bills, several different areas that address economic well-being for women and families. So there's about 15 different pieces to it. Some of my favorites actually include the idea that we are expanding sick time so in a couple of different ways. So as an employee, I can now earn 1 hour of sick time per 30 hours worked, and that hour can be applied and used more broadly. So it can be applied to care for my kids in a variety of ways, and it can be applied if I'm experiencing domestic violence at home or sexual violence at home. I can use that time to create a safe plan. I can use that time to care for familial caregiving. So there's a couple of broad applications for that that are really important. The raising of the minimum wage was a component of that as well. So recognizing that women disproportionately are in industries that pay a minimum wage, I believe 2/3 of all workers earning minimum wage are women. So raising that threshold up a little bit is one very, very tangible way to have an impact in the lives of women. It also expands for men and women the leave time. I'm looking at my notes here. So it expands unpaid leave under the Minnesota Parental Leave Act from 6 weeks to 12 weeks. And that's, you know, that doubles. Now it's unpaid, but it does double the time that you can use that time to welcome a new baby into your home and kind of create that transition that a lot of families need. So what it does do is it moves policy in the what I think is the right direction. Recognizing that in many cases, women carry a significant burden of raising families and holding down work at the same time. So it creates some protections that I think lift women and families up. I don't think it goes far enough. And I don't think it goes far enough in ways that support all families.
What are some of the changes or those areas that you think where it didn't go far enough, or some perhaps areas that it left uncovered?
Well, personally, I think that there is the need to expand sick time in all sectors for men and women. So I think that there is an expansion, potential expansion there. A couple of places that I'd like to see us move towards raising the reimbursement rate in a broader fashion for childcare. And for two reasons. One is that childcare is often provided by women, for women and families. And so I think there's kind of a fabric and network there that's really valuable. And I think it does, it's a pretty critical component we ask people to do to care for our children while we are working. And so I think we can value that with a higher base pay. One of the other areas that wasn't really touched is the Minnesota Family Investment Program, which is the cash assistance program for the state of Minnesota, also known as welfare. There are a number of strategies within the portfolio of MFIP, Minnesota Minnesota Family Investment Program that I think could be strengthened. And that includes raising cash assistance rates as you are transitioning to employment. So there's a couple of cliffs at which families, while they are making that leap into sustainable employment, can kind of fall off a fiscal cliff of their own as their cash benefits, as their food benefits taper down as well. And there is research that suggests that when we extend that, extend that step down in those benefits, that families really, really reap enormous benefits from that window being a little bit larger to enable greater stability.
One of the things that the legislation does is expand access to high-quality, affordable child care. How does that work?
Well, that's where we get into some of the details of it. And some of that is, I believe that piece in particular is about lifting the waiting list for child care, for state-supported and county-supported child care. So a lot of these bills came in with very, very specific end goals, and they had to maneuver themselves a little bit back and forth, you know, to get to the right compromise. I believe that particular component was going to start as expanding child care overall, right? So not just getting rid of a waiting list, but lifting some of those caps so that more people could qualify for child care. I think what ended up passing was kind of a compromise that recognize there's many families on the waiting list and trying to move those families up faster. But again, I think it doesn't quite go as far as many families need it.
It was one of the main compromises mm-hmm. that was actually dropped from the legislation.
A couple of other things that are included in the bill, closing the gender pay gap and protecting women from discrimination in the workplace. A lot of these things, I'm wondering how they're enforceable. If a woman is doing a job and a man is doing a job and the woman says, I'm doing the same thing he's doing, but I'm not being paid as much, an employer can say, well, this job is classified as this and this mm-hmm. job is classified mm-hmm. as that.
Yeah, you know, we see less of that than we used to. Part of closing that gender pay gap is about recognizing that there are a lot of sectors at which women excel professionally, or they can find ways to navigate into, you know, sustainable employment and child care in home health care and other sectors that tend to be lower wage earning jobs. So part of it is needing to set a table that shifts the way that we are tracking women into jobs that provide a more sustaining wage. And there is pieces in this legislation to incentivize getting women into more sectors that are traditionally held by men. So construction, more of those technical trades where we have just tons of data about how the education that we provide at community colleges or some of those hands-on trainings absolutely equates to higher wages in the end. So there's a couple of different ways I think that we can go about doing that.
Enforceability is always an issue. How do any of these laws actually get enforced? It relies in part on the good faith of employers. The burden falls on the person who is being discriminated against to report it. That can carry its own risks mm-hmm. And its own challenges and has to go through varieties of legal processes, administrative law processes to be pursued. And the remedies that are in place, I believe, begin with a letter. And following that, there would be a fine. And following that, there would be a higher fine. Two problems, I think, of enforceability. One is that the burden is on the person being discriminated against. And the second is that the remedies, while may they be encouraging, might not incur sufficient penalty or cost to make it worth the while for the employer actually to pay attention to the law.
Well, and I think it's interesting, too, because in enforcement, you know, in the last several decades, of course, human resources has emerged as a field, actually, you know, as a competency where employers, when they reach a threshold, address. And, you know, there's all these laws in place. Doesn't mean that people want to follow them. And so at this conference, Beth and I were both at last week, the Women's and Family Economic Security Conference that was held here in Duluth. It was a statewide conference held here in Duluth. There was a breakout session on WESA, on the Women's Economic Security Act, how it got started, how it went, what needs to happen next. And even just around that table, and these are well-educated women participating in policymaking, sharing their stories about exploitation in the workplace that happens today. And part of what I think this legislation does, it doesn't necessarily create new mechanisms. It raises the bar of conversation. It sets the expectation so that we can hold each other accountable in a very positive way.
I think one thing that does help with the enforceability, at least with regard to equal pay, is that one of the provisions is that the employers are no longer allowed to have as one of their stated policies that if employees talk about their pay, they could be fired. So that's no longer legal once this comes into effect. And that has been a major way of creating the kind of economic disparities is people aren't allowed to talk about what they earn. So that will be a huge step.
Several times in the legislation is the enhancing of protections for victims of violence.
Yeah.
And I guess it surprised me a little bit that there are enough victims of domestic and sexual violence that the law needed to address them.
Yes. Yes. It's unbelievable the rate at which women are either currently experiencing domestic or sexual violence or have experienced. And if you've ever, been friends or experienced it yourself, you know the amount of emotional and physical energy it requires for a family to transition, recognize, the elements of violence happening and then transition into safe spaces for them and their family. And having just kind of experienced that within the last few years with someone who I hold dear, you can see the emotional toil that takes. And so for me, it was really meaningful to see that the dialogue about this was happening on a statewide level, how you can acquire safe time, how you can use it, what it means, and what you don't have to explain to others about it. It's an incredibly daunting undertaking to leave a situation that is threatening the health and welfare of your family and to craft another. And so it was incredibly meaningful for me to see that this conversation is moving in that correct direction.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. We're talking about the Women's Economic Security Act this evening. Our guests in the studio are Duluth City Councilor Emily Larson, J.P. Rehnquist, a community activist around the issues of fathers and families, and the head of UMD's Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies Department, Beth Bartlett. J.P., let's start with the name of this, the Women's Economic Security Act. Many of these provisions apply to men and women. Is it a mistake to call it the Women's Economic Security Act?
I think it invites criticism from trolls, we call them online. I think it invites some criticism. A lot of these things that are in the act and a lot of the things that have already been talked about just in this conversation are things that should apply equally to men and women. People should get an equal wage for equal work. They should have equal access to health care. They should be able to take time off at the time of the birth or adoption of a child. Other family changes such as the death of a relative or other things, that should be something that those are just things that should be equal across all people. The problem is, and the value of naming something like a women's act or women infant children program, these are problems that disproportionately affect women, unfortunately. It's actually unfortunate that they affect anyone at all. People should be treated fairly. They should be kept safe, and there should be an understanding if they are in an insecure, economically insecure type of a situation, or if they are in, clearly if they're in an environment where there's violence or other things, that as in a broad sense, as moral people, as a just society, we should be providing for their needs and providing some compensation or time or other ways that they can deal with the ways that they have been wronged.
Traditionally, men have been seen as the breadwinners. It's a stereotype, but a man would no more tell his boss, I have to leave early to go to a football game or a play. I can't make the dinner with the clients tonight because my kid is performing in the orchestra. Do you think that men in 2014 Minnesota are going to take advantage of some of the provisions in this act, or are they going to feel, no, I'm going to lose a step professionally? There's no way I can do these things.
Well, let me tell you something that's just really current and really personal for me about that. That is, I spent much of the last 2 weeks in the hospital with my youngest daughter, who has developed a very serious condition and was in the ICU for many days. One of the things that I noticed in a very different way is that when kids are really sick, you know, they want their mom and their dad. And I noticed over the course of this time, I was really focused inwardly on what was going on with us and our family. But I did have some time to see and to even talk with other men who were there with their kids, who weren't going to leave their kids. So do I think that men are going to take more advantage of it? I think that more and more men are just going to demand, we just adopted this child, or, you know, I just had my partner just had a child, and I'm not going to work for the next 3 months. That is something that more and more and more men are feeling some of the freedom to do. There are things about our oldest culture, or kind of our most deeply held cultural values, when they're working well, which are that men and women work together to raise children, and we value families, and we and there are checks and balances available for if men are mistreating women and other things. And so I think that that's like a goal to work for. But in the meantime, we need to have some kind of practical steps that have things that have teeth, you know, and that is that it's best for me as a man to approach another, you know, male manager or a business owner or whatever it is and say, I see that this is something this is a way that you're mistreating your female workers, and I don't value that. I'm not going to shop at your store or whatever it is, and whatever the ways are that I can say that are providing some encouragement to that. But it's also good for there to be some teeth, and that is that this is illegal for you to treat, you know, this is illegal for you to, you know, demote someone if they take 12 weeks maternity leave. That's illegal. It's morally wrong, I think, but it's also illegal. And so laws and things like this start to, I don't even know if they do move the conversation along, but they get people who aren't listening or who don't want to be a part of the conversation to sort of snap up and pay attention.
Is the solution to the family situation and the balance in the family situation just to make it easier for women to do more? Or is part of the solution men coming forward and taking on additional responsibility? And it sounds, from what you're saying, as though the cultural shift is allowing men to do that now.
I think that actually that is what the solution is. The laws are good, and we need laws, and we need sometimes we need them to be really strong. But really what the solution when it comes to things like domestic violence or treating women fairly in the workplace, or this ridiculous thing of some men still feel it's okay to not partake equally in the care and raising of their children, or in the care and raising, you know, in the management of their household and other things. I mean, that's just preposterous. Memorial Day, we went and did some visiting and some other things. We were out at a little restaurant. My son, who's 5, this is something that I am very strict about with my son. And that is that I feel that he has a role, and this is kind of a warrior, or even like an Ogichida, is the way that I've been learning about it from the Anishinaabe, is not as a warrior who is, you know, about beating people up or hurting people or hitting people, but who has a broad sense of a protective force and energy that surrounds him. Anyway, one of his sisters was kind of teasing him, and he smacked her and didn't really hurt her. But I just told him, you're not allowed to hit your sister. You know, that's not something that's okay to do. And then we talked about different things to do when you're angry. I said, you have a role in life. One of your most, I said your most important, but I think I would doctor it to say one of your most important roles as a person, as part of this family, is that you need to protect your sisters. And I think that this is my belief about parenting him in this way, that I want him to grow up with the understanding that all people, including women, are sacred and deserve to be protected. And if we're angry or upset, he was legitimately angry and upset, and there was a little bit reflexive, this hitting thing that he did. But we need to figure out what to do with the anger. Ultimately, really what the solution is for men and boys to be raised in such a way that they treat women equally. you know, this equality thing is so much of in parenting, and all of it is so much is about us taking responsibility and being accountable for our actions and holding other men accountable, mm-hmm. as well as accepting the accountability that women hold us to as men.
I wanted to jump in because part of what you were saying that really, I think, resonates with some of this legislation for me and even in my own parenting is that idea that I think when we do raise the bar of expectation and opportunity for women, we are able to impact and shift a gender stereotyping more broadly mm-hmm. that I think frees up and empowers men to shift some of those confines that they are boxed in as well. So, you know, for me personally, the forward momentum of bringing women in more equal footing from a policy perspective and recognizing how that impacts on families really does free up that conversation so that men are more welcome and more encouraged to take the time that they need to care for their children and families, which is really significant. And it absolutely takes that ally relationship of men and women working together to make those changes and to have them last.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. We're talking about the Women's Economic Security Act this evening, and our guests in the studio are Duluth City Councilor Emily Larson, J.P. Rehnquist, a community activist around issues of fathers and families, and the head of UMD's Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies Department, Beth Bartlett. Beth, I mentioned earlier to Emily that it was really disturbing to see in how many situations this bill talks about victims of sexual assault or domestic violence or even stalking. And it made me wonder if there are really so many women being victimized in this way that it was necessary to address a population in a statewide bill.
Well, we are talking about at least a quarter of the population of women in this country. Who experience sexual assault, and those statistics vary by race as well. It is 2.5 times higher for Native women than it is for white women and African-American women, and those are the effects of colonization. And so yes, 1 out of 4 to 1 out of 3, depending on which statistics you look at, are victims of sexual assault. The same numbers for those who are victims of intimate partner violence. So, yes, we are talking about a significant population. And stalking, perhaps we don't talk about as much. I myself have been a victim of stalking twice. And I think about how that has affected my life. Certainly, if we're talking about economics, I had to drop out of school because of one stalker. I had to, one other one was related to my workplace, and that affected my job. So, and I've known students who have not been able to complete their education because of stalkers. So, and the trauma that, as Emily was talking about, of the sexual violence, I've seen, you see that in students. All of a sudden, they can't concentrate. They can't turn in their work. They stop coming to class. That has long-term consequences, sometimes lifetime consequences. So, yes, we're talking about a huge percentage of the population, far too large part of the population.
One of the other statistics that troubled me for obvious reasons. Twice as many elderly women in Minnesota are living in poverty as men. Now, is this just because women tend to live longer?
Not at all. No. There are a number of factors in that. One is certainly just the fact that women are paid significantly less for the same work as men. And again, that varies by race considerably. It's about 79% to 80% for white women, about 58% for African-American women, 48% for Hispanic women, and about 38% for Native American women as compared to white men. So just in that factor alone, for the same work, same pay, but that there's that kind of disparity. As I had mentioned earlier, this act will affect the fact that we can now talk about our salaries and wages with each other and begin to understand that perhaps not all of us are being paid the same. So part of it is that. And part of it is what was alluded to with regard to child care workers, for example, who are among the lowest paid workers, as our home health care aides and other health care aides, that what we value in the society tends to be what traditionally men do, or I was thinking about it this morning, care for technology and care for machines we value much more highly than care for people in terms of where we put our money. And we invest significantly more in those fields. And those tend to be where men go as opposed to women. But that filters out over the years. Men used to be, clerical workers tended to be predominantly males. Now it's 99% female. And as that has happened, the pay for that work has decreased significantly. They are among the least paid workers. Same thing with computer science. It began as an all-female field and now has become mostly an all-male field. And we see the salaries have skyrocketed. As women have gone into veterinary medicine, those salaries have lowered. So partly there's a valuing, there's a different valuing of what women do and care work and nurturing work and care for the body, care for the sick, care for children is not valued as less. But there's also if women get into it, then the salaries go down. If men get into it, the salaries go up. So there's also a more subtle discrimination going on there. Being a mother, not to say that men don't parent, but we do have some of these statistics, particularly in parenting in general, but it's generally mothers who take on that role as the primary caregiver. We do know that just going into initial salary offers, mothers will be offered at the get-go $11,000 less per year than non-mothers, because women are more likely to take on those childcare roles, are more likely to step out of the workforce at various times or to take part-time jobs, and those might not have the kind of retirement benefits attached to them. So build up less retirement over the years. Social Security is based on how much you earn. So if your initial pay is less, if your job is not valued and you're paid less, if you step in and out of the workforce, if you aren't in long enough to get those benefits, that will all determine your salary or your earnings in retirement. And over a lifetime, that adds up on average to about $1.2 million less per year than men.
Wow. I was kind of interested. I read an article and was interested in some of the comments that that were made by folks that opposed the bill. And Senator Carrie Rudd said that the act sends the wrong message to women. She's quoted as saying, "Members, what are we telling women? That unless government steps up and helps you, that you're not smart enough, you're not tough enough, you're not capable enough to be successful on your own."
Well, that assumes that we are all individually responsible for our financial success in the world. It assumes a level playing field to begin with. Personally, I don't believe in such a thing as the self-made man or the self-made woman, that we are all made by communities and by the various ways in which we enter life. We are all advantaged or disadvantaged in various ways. One of those is gender. There's also race, class, availability of parents, health, disability, varieties of things advantage or disadvantage us. But there are structural inequities in the system. And I think what the Women's Economic Security Act addresses is or begins to address are some of those structural inequities that have nothing to do with an individual and how hard they work. One of the stories at the panel on Thursday last week was about the woman healthcare worker who was working four jobs. She's pretty tough. She's working pretty hard, and she's not making a living. These are the realities of not being paid as much and not having those benefits.
Community Conversations is a monthly program here on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson. Thanks to our guests, Duluth City Councilor Emily Larson, J.P. Rehnquist, community activist around issues of fathers and families, and the head of UMD's Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies Department, Beth Bartlett. Community Conversations is produced by Lisa Johnson with help from Mike Nowitzki and funded by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.